For decades, Americans have come to view the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan as an indispensable ally in the Middle East, committing billions of taxpayer dollars to support Jordan's budget, economy, and military. Jordan's peace treaty with Israel, its strategic position between Israel, Iraq, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, and its pro-American military and intelligence services remain critical to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And yet, challenges inside this relationship are reaching alarming levels. From harboring a most wanted terrorist, to inciting violence against Israel, to a member of parliament charged with arms trafficking across the Jordanian border with Israel, U.S. policymakers are considering their options. Hi, I'm Rich Goldberg, senior advisor at FDD, filling in for Cliff May. Today I'm joined by FDD's senior vice president for research, Dr. Jonathan Shanzer, and Joe Truesman, research analyst at FDD's Long War Journal, as we assess the state of the U.S.-Jordanian relationship. Thanks for joining me here on Foreign Policy. John, Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rich.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Let's dive right in. John, why don't I start with you? Before we get into the latest details of what's been going on, what we've been tracking at FDD, why don't you talk to listeners about why Jordan matters? Why does Jordan matter to the United States? Why does Jordan matter to Israel?
Sure. It's a great question. And let me just say up front that I still believe through it all that Jordan is an incredibly important ally to the United States. And it's an incredibly important ally to Israel. And the role that it plays in the Middle East cannot really be replaced in any real way. And so maybe just a word of caution that as I criticize Jordan today, because I think it's warranted, it does not mean that I'd like to jettison Jordan as an ally. The story is basically this, that Jordan, I think, had a really interesting relationship with Israel for many years. Even from the beginning of the conflict, starting in 1948, there was strange communication that was going on between the Israelis and the Jordanians. The Israelis, I think, somehow implicitly understood that Jordan could play a moderating role in the region. And communication began where the former king Hussein and various Israeli leaders had communication with one another. They were warning each other about impending wars, and they were communicating in ways that benefited both countries. And that was something that I think did not go unnoticed by the United States. Finally, after the 1993 Oslo Accords were signed between Israel and the Palestinians, that I think gave a green light to the Jordanians that they could make their peace with Israel too. So they signed that agreement in 1994. Since that time, Israel has been providing Jordan with gas, with water, with intelligence, with military assistance. And alongside that, the United States has invested significant funds, actually just signed a recent MOU to the tune of $1.5 billion a year. There's military assistance and training as well. So in other words, Jordan has become a core part of the U.S.-led world order in the Middle East. It has willingly played that role, and it has willingly embraced a relationship with Israel until probably about 3 or 4 years ago, where we really began to see an uptick in vitriol coming out of Amman. And it's coming at an odd time. It's coming actually at a time that is really unwelcome as the United States tries to stabilize the region and pivot to Asia. And while Israel is trying to keep Iran from going nuclear and to keep the region from blowing a lid.
Now, don't leave us on a cliffhanger there. 3 or 4 years ago, what happened? You've just described what appears to be an excellent trajectory in a bilateral relationship for the Israelis, certainly for the U.S. We have other interests at stake when we think about our presence in Iraq and Syria, broader Middle East, counter-extremism, the role Jordanian intelligence plays and security forces play in the region. When we think about Arab intelligence and security, Jordan's at the top of the list on capabilities and some of the things we talk about, the value we have, many of the benefits of the U.S.-Israel relationship. not dissimilar in some of the benefits we have for our own strategic interests in the U.S.-Jordanian relationship as well, from a security perspective, counterterrorism, and most particularly. What happened exactly that suddenly derails this? Why are we on this new sort of environment, this new trajectory?
You know, I wish I could say there was one thing. I would argue that that number one, the relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu and the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, has not been stellar. And for some time, actually, it was the head of the Mossad, then head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, that was navigating that relationship on behalf of the Israelis and the Jordanians. On top of that, I think Israel found itself maybe a little distracted by some of its new peace partners. You kind of imagine that you've got a wife since 1994, and then all of a sudden you've got maybe some new girlfriends. You could maybe describe that as what's just happened with the Israelis with the advent of the Abraham Accords, right? This was, just not too long ago. This was 2020. Where all of a sudden the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan all come out of the woodwork. They normalize with Israel, and Israel spending more of its time thinking about how to please and work with some of these new partners. But I think both of those things are insufficient in understanding what's going on here. I think Jordan has gone through the ringer economically. It has been unstable politically, and something to the order of 80% of its population is Palestinian. And if you're trying to perhaps allow for a safety valve among a restive population, you're trying to make sure that you keep a lid on the political and economic frustrations in your country, it actually makes perfect sense to really engage in this kind of vitriolic rhetoric that we have seen Jordan engage in with regard to Israel. I think a lot of it is unprovoked. I think a lot of it is exaggerated. I think a lot of it doesn't need to be made public, but it has been made public. And I think it serves that role of appeasing that majority Palestinian population that have hold a dim view of Israel and probably always will.
It's interesting to me, John, when you talk about it, because as I reflect on certainly the last 10 years plus, and I look for some of the indicators that this is going to at some point become a strategic contradiction that both the Israelis and the Americans will have to deal with. There are signals along the way. We know that UNRWA, we've talked a lot about UNRWA at FDD and in past podcasts the Cliff has hosted, you and I, John, have written on this. We know that Jordan hosts one of the largest populations of Palestinian refugees, quote unquote, served by the UN Relief and Works Agency. Only they're not really refugees. They're living in Jordan, essentially as Jordanian citizens. You could easily convert the assistance the United States gives to UNRWA for quote unquote refugees to bilateral assistance to Jordan. You just mentioned we're giving them almost $1.5 billion, but the Jordanians won't let that happen. They, in fact, they're the leading opposition among friends of the United States to any sort of reform to UNRWA. Clearly something else going on below the surface there. And Joe, I'd like you to weigh in on this as well. We've also had for many years an indictment from the U.S. Justice Department for one of the FBI's most wanted terrorists in Alam al-Tamimi, who is wanted for 22 years ago being part of the Sbarro terrorist attack. We all recall, for those who remember, at the height of the Intifada, the second Intifada, that horrible attack killed two American citizens. And she's hanging out in Jordan now as a talk show host, celebrity, kind of outrageous, while there's a rewards for justice bounty on her head. How does that exactly even happen?
Yeah, you nailed it. Ahram Tamimi is basically, she's a celebrity in Jordan. Like you said, she played a role in the Sbarro bombing in Jerusalem, the pizzeria that killed, I believe, 15 people, including two American citizens. Yeah, she has a bounty on her head. And she was released. Actually, she was in Israeli custody. She was in jail. She was in prison, but she was released during the Gilad Shalit deal in 2011. And she moved to Jordan, where she has been in refuge ever since. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, I think. But there are opportunities, I think, to have her extradited. But we can talk more about that after, I think. But yeah, she's living in the life of luxury right now. I mean, her husband was deported to Qatar not so long ago. Which is nice, I suppose, but it's not her, and she needs to be brought to justice for what she did. So right now, opportunities are there, have presented themselves to possibly have her extradited, but we can talk about more of that after.
And for those that weren't tracking the Gilad Shalit reference, this is an Israeli soldier who was captured many years ago. There was a lot of pressure on the Israeli government to negotiate with Hamas some sort of a prisoner exchange. And in fact, ultimately, he was traded back to Israel and released from captivity in exchange for an enormous number of Palestinian terrorists who were imprisoned. One of them, Tamimi, who had been tried and convicted and imprisoned for that role in Sabaro. And she then moved to Jordan, where she's been given safe haven since then. John, I want to come back to you. Let's fast forward. Now we're back here in 2023. King Abdullah of Jordan has now been on the throne for 24 years, right? It'll be 25 years, I think, next year since King Hussein, his father, died. That's a generation of really being able to compare a record of King Abdullah to his father. How do you compare Abdullah's foreign policy, particularly towards Israel, as compared to his father's?
Before I answer that question, I just want to say one quick thing about Ahmam Tamimi. When you talk to the Jordanians about her case, they will say that she already served a sentence and that when she was released by the Israelis in that Gilad Shalit prisoner swap, her term was done and that the request to extradite her essentially put her into double jeopardy and that pursuant to their legal system, their hands are tied. Now, whether that's true or not, we could discuss. And by the way, whether that's respectful of American law or America's needs, given the great weight that America holds in Jordan, I think that's another discussion entirely. But I did want to make sure that that folks understand at least the Jordanian perspective. I'm not saying that it's right, but it is, I think, the argument that's been made.
And they claim on top of that, John, that there is no extradition treaty in effect right now, even though we know that there was one signed in the 1990s and it was in effect. They somehow claim it was either nullified or it didn't go into effect, and so that they don't actually have to extradite just because the Justice Department has indicted following her release from Israeli prison.
Correct. And I think, and I think the Israelis look at this and perhaps some in the United States. Certainly the families of those Americans that were killed will look at this and say that Jordan's dragging its feet and that if it weren't Israelis or Jews that were killed, that perhaps the response would be different. But I do think it's important to at least understand that there are at least legalistic ways of looking at this challenge. It's not just simply a finger in the eye of the United States or of Israel, but that, there are processes that are being worked through. And I don't know if they're done.
I agree. But my only point in bringing it up is there is a street element to why is not extradited
without,
to the United
without
States.
Question.
She's a celebrity on the Palestinian
correct.
Street.
Yeah. And I think Joe's point that she has some sort of a celebrity status. There's something rather sickening about that from a cultural perspective, to put it mildly. Now, as for the question you asked about the sort of generational change, when King Hussein died, I remember I was actually in graduate school and I watched him come home and kiss the ground at the tarmac of the airport as he came home from cancer treatment, knowing that this was likely to be the end of his life. And then we had this dramatic sort of changing of the guards where the crown prince was dismissed and King Hussein's oldest son, Abdullah, who was trained as a military man his whole life, was suddenly thrust into the spotlight. And he actually, I've read his autobiography and he talks about how this was actually a jarring moment for him. He wasn't quite ready for it. He hadn't been groomed for it. But nevertheless, I think a lot of us at the time were thinking to ourselves, great young guy, right? Has trained in the West, understands America, understands Britain, understands Jordan. But I think what we found over the years is that he does not necessarily have the same political skills as his father. He's maybe not as invested in the kind of tribal politics and local politics of Jordan, trying to figure out how to get the East Bankers and West Bankers to align and to embrace a common vision for the Jordanian state. And I think there's also something else that in my mind is really a huge difference. And you can read it in his autobiography where he talks about how he sees Israel as the primary problem in the region. He takes a really not a terribly nuanced perspective about this. You don't see him talking about Iran. You don't see him talking about Hezbollah or Hamas or any of the hatred that has been taught across the region by a range of bad actors. And so he sort of, I think, takes that at face value. So when you don't invest in the politics of the people necessarily the way your father did, and you're looking for ways to rally your crowds, I do think that Israel has always been the lowest common denominator in the Arab world, the disdain for Israel. It's a rather easy card to play. And unfortunately, I think the king is playing it.
Joe, as I start leading up to the most current tensions that John has touched on a little bit, I am struck by the year 2017. It definitely was one of the low points in recent memory until now in the bilateral relationship. And it took a long time for the bilateral relationship to recover from the events that took place in 2017. One of them was something that was, you could say, just, you know, an unfortunate incident, unpredictable, and perhaps the handling by all sides of it and the optics of it is what the problem was. That was the incident where there was an Israeli diplomat and a security official at the Israeli embassy in Amman who had an apartment that was owned by the Israelis in Amman. There was a worker there. He claimed to have been attacked by the worker. The Israeli official responded, killed the worker, but also accidentally shot the landlord in the apartment as well. This created a lot of media coverage inside Jordan. There was really, like, you know, almost a siege going on where the Jordanians wanted the Israeli official turned over for prosecution. He was hiding out in the Israeli compound. They had to negotiate his exfiltration to Israel that the Jordanians would allow. Once he came home, he was celebrated by Prime Minister Netanyahu as sort of a hero status who had survived and killed a terrorist. And that didn't sit well with the king in Amman. And that really sparked outrage in the bilateral relationship. That's one thing that happened. But the other thing that really, I think, is interesting that happened that year was the installation of some security elements, including metal detectors on the Temple Mount or on the Al-Aqsa compound, as the Muslims would call it, that sparked outrage in the Muslim world, but in fact, intense protests and almost riots that were destabilizing in Jordan protesting this move, and the Israelis ultimately succumbing to the pressure and removing these security elements on the Temple Mount, including those metal detectors. What is it about Jerusalem, about the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa, that creates this incredible emotional ability to create these tensions, whether it's in the broader Muslim world, whether it's unique for Jordan? But it certainly seems that it triggers Amman in a unique way as compared to other Arab partners and allies of Israel and of the United States. And then, John, if you wanted to weigh in on that as well after Joe.
I can briefly say that, you know, it's I could say the obvious. It's an Islamic holy site, right? And the Jordanians have custodianship of it, and they see any change of the status quo, right, as a major problem. You know, like you mentioned, with the changing of with adding even small things like metal detectors, right? But I think it's also like a power struggle. Okay, we see a lot, especially media, especially recently during Ramadan this year. We see this struggle where between Palestinians and Israeli police, Israeli border police, where, you know, Israeli police will go in and clash with Palestinians. And it obviously, yes, it looks bad on TV, but I think what the Jordanians are trying to do, and have been trying to do for some time now, is, you know, they want to make sure they're trying to establish themselves as the custodians of the mosque, of the Temple Mount or Al-Aqsa Mosque. And but there's other elements here, and we see it, this power struggle with even Hamas as well. For example, just now during Ramadan, there's a huge pro-Hamas banners flying on the grounds of Al-Aqsa Mosque. So there's, you can see there's different elements there of this power struggle between the Jordanians, the Israelis, and now Hamas. But again, it's a very sensitive site, and it just goes back to establishing who the dominant force is that controls the mosque. But again, I'd love to hear from John about this.
Yeah, I mean, look, the 1994 peace agreement gives Jordan an official role to play in the custodian of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They have control over elements of the Waqf, as it's known, the religious authority. They've got guards that they can dispatch. And this bestows upon the Jordanians a certain amount of legitimacy. I mean, don't forget, first of all, that the Jordanians between 1948 and 1967 occupied East Jerusalem and therefore occupied this mosque, and they controlled it. And this was when the king had designs over, the former king had designs over all of the West Bank and wanted, you know, after 67, wanted to reclaim it. And what's interesting is that now that this has been formally established since the mid-1990s, what we're beginning to see is a certain amount of encroachment on the part of the Jordanian government. I mean, during the UN General Assembly last year, there were statements made by the king where he's accusing the Israelis of violating the religious rights of Christians, right? This is a step beyond where I think Jordan's role has always been. I think a lot of people found it very confusing, not least because we didn't really see the facts associated with these claims. It was a kind of a spurious claim to begin with. But you get a sense that the king is really trying to grab more authority or grab more power in Jerusalem. And that's, of course, something that the Israelis are not going to be terribly interested in doing. I think they're very happy to have an outside friendly partner helping to ensure calm on the Temple Mount. But of course, the Jordanians haven't been doing that in recent years. As we know, the rhetoric has gotten sharper, it's gotten nastier, and if anything, it seems to be egging on the rioters that we've seen sieging the Temple Mount, playing soccer, firing off fireworks at Israeli border guards. And you don't see the Jordanians telling them to cool their heels. You don't tell them, you don't hear them telling the rioters that they need to halt that activity. What we see is, you know, excoriation of Israel on a very public stage. And so, you know, the very role of Jordan right now as custodian of the mosque, I think, you know, it's a difficult one. The Israelis, I think, want Jordan to maintain the role. They enjoy the relationship. They see the value of Jordan. But I think Jordan, in many ways, over the last couple of years, has become something of a liability. And that is the rub.
And that is a perfect segue to bring us to the most recent tensions. We just left Ramadan. For the most part, it had been a quiet Ramadan, one of the quieter that had been recorded, until a week of a bit of turmoil, with many pointing fingers at the Iranians for fomenting violence, a multi-front escalation against the Israelis, but also incitement coming from the Palestinians, and certainly from the Jordanians as well. John, maybe we'll start with you. Maybe unpack what you saw play out. What was the Jordanian piece of the puzzle here? Was it truly incitement to violence? Was it more bystander observations that we would characterize as unhelpful, but not actual incitement? Where would you put Jordan and the various people in Jordan into the camp right now, as you saw the tensions flaring and violence erupting?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think the first thing you got to do is just take a look at the previous two Ramadans, starting with the one from 2021, where there was this battle over the disputed homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem, and Hamas was, you know, essentially threatening war, and the Israelis are trying to keep control over riots on the Temple Mount. And as the Israeli border police do this, you have Ayman al-Safadi, the foreign minister of Jordan, coming out and saying that Israel's playing with fire, right? As if it has no right to do this, that despite its sovereignty, it shouldn't actually step foot on the Temple Mount. You could see back then, that was really what got my attention before I started writing about this, is, you know, what kind of ally, what kind of partner is Jordan if you've got Hamas, right, an Iran-backed terrorist organization engaging in this kind of rhetoric and action, and the Jordanians are saying that the Israelis are playing with fire, as if to basically encourage what's going on from the so-called resistance. That happens again last year during Ramadan tensions. Last year, thankfully, we saw a far less ugly battle. It was just as we would call it, a mini war or mini operation between the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Israel, with, again, tensions flaring on the Temple Mount. And then this year, I think we could just press rewind and then play similar kind of rhetoric leading up to Ramadan, with Jordan once again warning that Israel, you know, shouldn't take action against those that are defiling the mosque or barricading themselves inside. But really what struck me this year was a line uttered by the king where he called upon the Muslim world to deter, that's a direct quote, Israeli actions in Jerusalem, right? To me, that seemed like he was calling upon them to take action. And that means, at least in my mind, physical action, kinetic action. And then, as if on cue, the next night, we see people barricading themselves in the Al-Aqsa compound again, playing soccer, firing rockets, fireworks rather, at Israeli border police who are trying to gain control of the situation. Then, of course, like clockwork, the Jordanians come out and they condemn Israel for doing what any country would in its sovereign territory when there's unrest. And so one gets a sense that the Jordanians are okay with the idea of fanning the flames of this conflict. As I said, it looks like they're taking the side of Hamas, or even Iran, which is, of course, the actor we believe to be behind a lot of this activity. And this all comes, as we just saw, outreach by the Islamic Republic to Jordan, raising questions about what is going on here.
And obviously, in all of these statements issued after you see violence on the Temple Mount, people barricading themselves inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, bringing all kinds of explosives and fireworks and knives and rocks and things that are clearly desecrating a holy site. This is not allowed under Islam to go into Al-Aqsa with these kind of things and do what you see on these videos people doing. And there's never been, that I know of, a condemnation of the conduct itself, right? It's always a blame Israel for going in and stopping it and preventing further violence. I don't understand how you respond to that, how that's okay.
It puts Israel, it puts Israel in an impossible situation, right? Israel is obviously not a Muslim country, but it is trying to work through Jordan to bestow a certain amount of legitimacy on the way in which the third holiest site in Islam is maintained, and how traffic can be monitored and how behavior can be structured. And here you have, you know, these things happening year after year now. Again, we believe that it's incited primarily by the Iranians and Iranian proxies. And you see Jordan sort of saying, you know, shrugging, if you will, at this kind of malign activity, this, you know, horrific behavior, right? I mean, forget whether it's ultimately life-threatening, but it's rioting at the end of the day. And you would think that this would be offensive to the custodian of this mosque. You'd think, by the way, that perhaps even the Saudis might weigh in on this. or the Emiratis, or some of Israel's other Sunni normalization partners, that it would be really the right thing to say, regardless of how you feel about the Palestinian issue, that, hey, guys, this is not the way to express your frustration with your lack of, direction with your national project, right? I mean, that's ultimately what they're doing, is they are acting out their frustrations over their inability to achieve a state by rioting on the third holiest site in Islam. And you'd think that that would be offensive to Arabs and Muslims around the world.
Joe, as I build up towards the next incident that we just saw occur, just in the last 96 hours or so, we're still processing it. I want to step back and talk to you about your work tracking the violence in the West Bank in particular, and then also parts of Jerusalem, where we've seen a lot of terrorist attacks, incidents sourced from, including this week with the latest ramming attack that injured several individuals in Jerusalem. What are you seeing? What has been the trend? What is the source of this violence? And in any way, are you seeing any Jordanian links in your research until now?
Right. So, yeah, I've been following this closely since 2001, about I'd say the summer of 2001, in June 2001, to be more precise, where this West Bank violence, I believe, erupted. And, first it started out with armed clashes between Palestinian terrorist groups, Islamic Jihad, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Hamas, and others, clashing with Israeli troops operating in the West Bank, primarily Jenin, northern West Bank, Jenin and Nablus. But that started to build up, at the beginning in 2022, we started seeing these clashes became routine. I started observing groups backed by Iran, expanding in the northwest, in the northern West Bank, specifically, again, Islamic Jihad, a proxy of Iran. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the weakness of the Palestinian Authority, right? Especially in those areas where they don't have much control over. I think that's a big component to this. And this just continued throughout 2022. There were clashes in the West Bank, and then armed groups started to rise, and or new armed groups such as the Lion's Den came about. And then in March, we started seeing this, it turned for the worse. Inside Israel, we started seeing terrorist attacks in Be'er Sheva, in Tel Aviv, and Hadera, and in other places, and which is, as you mentioned, going on still continues right now. So it's not good. It's not good. A lot of this, I believe, goes back to Iran, Iran's proxies, Hezbollah, for example. An article I wrote in December last year, we detailed how Hezbollah was smuggling arms into the West Bank. And so a lot of this, again, ties back to Iran. As far as the Jordanians are concerned, the only link that I can see really is incitement. Okay, incitement by members of the parliament, lawmakers, where you hear things like earlier this year, for example, it's a perfect example. I think it was in the beginning of January. There was this Jordanian MP, Yonat Freihat. Okay. He referred to Israelis as the sons of apes and pigs, and that they should know that a reaction, and I'm directly quoting here, a reaction from the Jordanians and the Palestinians will happen, and it will be with bullets. All right, so that's pretty significant. So there's a lot of incitement, but it's coming from everywhere now. Jordanians, Iran-backed groups in Gaza, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon. So there's a lot going on. Israel's in a lot of trouble, I'm afraid to say. And it's a lot of information, a lot of stuff is going on. So it's a concerning moment, in my opinion.
And there's one other interesting element here that I feel like we had a research gap on, and maybe we're getting an answer, maybe we're not. I think we still need to unpack what's going on a little more. But that is, we've seen plenty of reports over the last several months of Israeli military, Israeli police cracking down on various arms trafficking rings, gun smuggling, major light, mostly light arms that are moving into the West Bank from somewhere, organized by someone. And it's not exactly clear whether it's connected to Iranian links. Is it connected to the violence per se? Is it connected to gang violence that we see among Arab society in general, which is, by the way, its own problem and a whole other podcast to have. And now over the weekend, we see Israel stunning arrest of a Jordanian MP, another MP, which I'm sure you've been tracking and can talk about, on charges of arms trafficking, arms and gold being brought across the border to support someone who I think we still need to figure out who and for what and how long has this been going on for? Is it linked to other incidents that we've seen? So why don't you, Joe, maybe start to help us unpack this. What did we see over the weekend? Who is this member of parliament? What do we know about the allegations and what might it all be connected to?
Right. Yeah, this is a very serious incident, actually, considering what's been going on in the West Bank and Israel over the last year and a half. So just to briefly unpack it. So Jordanian lawmaker, Imad al-Adwan, he's a member of the Palestine Committee, staunch supporter of Palestinians, very anti-Israel. He's a guy that has gone publicly, has said that you know, he supports Hamas, he supports the so-called Palestinian resistance, and he's even greeted Abu Obaida, who is the Hamas military man that usually just comes out during war. He makes his own speeches, but so this MP on Saturday night, he was crossing into Israel from Jordan. I believe it was at the Allenby Bridge. The Israelis got a tip. They got intelligence, according to reports. They got intelligence that a smuggling attempt was in the works, okay? And they stop this MP. They find a large cache of weapons and gold. Now, when I say a large cache of weapons, I don't mean like, I'm not saying like 10 automatic rifles and some handguns. This is dozens upon dozens of handguns and rifles. I mean, he could have supported an army with what he had, which is very concerning. And this is what brings me to the point that what's been going on in the West Bank. The concern here is, and we don't know yet, but the concern is this Jordanian MP was smuggling arms to Palestinian groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. That's the concern here. But we don't know for sure. So again, super serious incident. We don't know what's going to happen. Unfortunately, there's not a lot going on here as far as answers, getting answers. But the concern, again, this MP was attempting to smuggle arms to the West Bank. But another important point is, okay, so was it, is that something he did under his own initiative? Or was he just, an intermediary? Maybe he was smuggling for a foreign actor. We don't know that. I don't think it was the Jordanian government, but, you know, these are just questions I'm raising, just some thoughts. So this is very strange, but again, a serious incident.
Joe, are you sure that that this wasn't a parliamentarian bringing in weapons and money for Ben Gvir's new armed force that's supposed to be?
Yeah. The militia, yeah.
He's supposed to keep calm in the West Bank.
Or the National Guard.
Right. I mean, it could have been that. Why are you jumping to conclusions, man?
I guess you could say maybe, but I doubt it. I don't think they're on good terms.
John, that actually was a funny way to bring me to my last substantive question before I ask you both sort of outlooks and where we go from here. But I do want to probably be the voice of some of our listeners who have been reading the news and would say, well, you know, maybe the Israeli government has some responsibility to bear here in the deterioration of relations with Jordan and the response that we're seeing on the Jordanian side of feeling that they need to incite, that they need to respond in this way because there is this right-wing government now in Israel. And we saw the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, go to Paris and give a speech with a map on his lectern of so-called Greater Israel or Biblical Israel, that go back to the Bible. There's parts of modern day Jordan that had two of the tribes of it, two and a half of the tribes of Israel that occupied that east bank of the Jordan River. And that's, you know, on maps for those that believe in this greater Israel concept one day, drew blistering reaction from the Jordanians diplomatically, a big headache for Netanyahu and the government. Where would you say that comes down? I mean, what is the Smotrich Ben-Gvir effect on the relations, or is that an excuse that the Jordanians would use that does not justify what we're seeing?
Look, there's no question in my mind that Jordanians were offended by the Smotrich lectern. I think there are a lot of Israelis that were offended by the Smotrich lectern, for that matter. And you're seeing them out in the streets, right? Testing. And obviously there's some tumult in Israel right now over a range of political issues. And, you know, the political perspectives of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir in particular have a lot of Israelis deeply uncomfortable. But, you know, I don't think that gives Jordan a green light to excoriate Israel publicly, when what we need is a system of predictability and stability in the region. That should be the first goal and the last goal of the Hashemite kingdom right now, is to maintain stable ties with Israel, given the importance of Israel in terms of its water, its gas, its, you know, its security, its relationship with the United States. All of these things are crucial to Jordan's survival. One gets a sense that, you know, Jordan, I think, is under the assumption that it's too weak to fail. That Israel won't let it, you know, part ways with the Israelis. The United States won't let it happen. And so I think there's a sense anyway among the Jordanians that they can get away with more of this. This is not to say that Israel is perfect in any way. I mean, I think it's fair for the Jordanians to, you know, engage with the Israelis and to criticize the way they handle what goes on in the Temple Mount during Ramadan. It's fair for them to criticize Israel and its responses to rockets out of Gaza. It's fair for them to criticize Israel for its reluctance to engage with the Palestinians on two-state solution issues. However, I think most of their criticism, number one, ignores the fact that there are problems on the other side, whether it's the behavior that we see by Palestinians on the Temple Mount, whether it's the rocket attacks perpetrated by Hamas or other proxies of Iran. And certainly the Palestinians are not innocent here when it comes to foot dragging as it relates to the two-state solution. And the Palestinian Authority is as guilty as Israel in terms of not wanting to come back to the table, not wanting to negotiate. The Jordanians seem to be content to ignore all of that. But I think worse, to air all of their grievances in a public way. And all that does is it erodes confidence in the U.S.-led structures that have been created in the region over the last 20, 30 years. And as I think we all know here, that's not a good thing for the United States as the U.S. looks to pivot out of the region, as the U.S. looks to begin to focus more squarely on the Indo-Pacific. In order for us to be able to do that, we need stability in the region. And I think the Jordanians are undercutting the stability that we need.
John, you brought me exactly to my last question to both of you.
That was my plan. That was my plan.
And well, it's a masterful plan. And that is to go back to one of our first points, and that is we have a situation where the United States taxpayer is providing, I believe the fiscal year 2024 request from the State Department is over $1 billion in economic support funds for Jordan and $400 million in military financing support for Jordan, and then some other odds and ends and other accounts and spigots here and there. Let's call it $1.5 billion. And you have a thriving Jordan caucus on Capitol Hill. I remember being a part of it when I worked for Senator Kirk and before that Congressman Kirk. Strong support for the king from the foreign ops subcommittees of appropriations, House and Senate. The king is very smart when it comes to U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy. He comes to Capitol Hill every year when he visits. He goes to meet with the appropriations committee, not the big one, not the full committee, the subcommittees of the House and Senate, and sits there and briefs members and talks to them about what's going on. Really understands where the bread is buttered in the U.S. from the taxpayers. And has this air, as you just said, that Who's going to cut me off? Who's going to condition my assistance? If Jordan collapses, what are you going to do? You know, it'll be a security disaster for the United States, for Israel, for the region, if anything happens to my government. And if you pull my money, then I will be destabilized. The kingdom could fall. You're not going to let that happen. In an environment like that, where there is this feeling of entitlement and an encroachment on the basic understandings that had led to U.S. commitment of this kind, steadfast commitment to Jordan, while balancing the interest that we have in a stable and strong Jordan with trying to curtail this bad behavior we're increasingly seeing, what do we do? What do you advise a policymaker to do? I ask you, John and Joe, please go ahead.
Look, for me, it's easy. We've never spelled out what we want from Jordan in the current environment. And what we should want from Jordan is for them to maintain a strong defense, for them to continue to serve as a buffer between Israel and a generally hostile Arab world, and to keep their grievances quiet. That's it, right? This is actually not very hard. Take our money, take our training, keep your mouth shut, right? That really should be the beginning and end of it. It doesn't need to be any more complicated than this. And I think that there needs to be first probably private statements by the U.S. And if that fails, then public statements. By the way, maybe we could also add to that that maybe Jordan should just join the Negev summit, be part of the Abraham Accords infrastructure that it actually belongs in because it has a longstanding peace agreement with Israel, rather than boycotting it, which is what we see now. They didn't even show up to the signing of the Abraham Accords in 2020. That was just, I think, an embarrassment for the entire U.S.-led system. Again, the idea here is that we need to be very deliberate in describing what Jordan's role needs to be in the region. I don't think we need to get to the point where we're threatening to cut off funds. That seems like the nuclear option that is a year or two down the line. I think just laying out clear terms for what is expected of an American ally in an important strategic region, that should be enough for a country that relies so heavily upon the United States the way Jordan does.
Joe.
Yeah, I think John put it perfectly. I would add a couple of things. I would like to see Jordan become more active in almost like a buffer, like John was saying, but more active as far as what's happening at the Temple Mount. Hamas, as from what I've observed, Hamas is a strong presence on the grounds of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, especially during sensitive times like we just saw, like during Ramadan. There's a strong Palestinian base in Jordan, but I would like to see Jordan take a more active role in tempering Hamas down, at least, because it's every year I feel like it's things, especially at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, are getting a little worse, more and more, or they're building up, and something, and Hamas and the other groups are using events at Al-Aqsa Mosque as a pretext to attack Israel, right? So we saw it just a few weeks ago with the multi-front conflict from Gaza, Lebanon, Syria. So I'd like to see a more active role there. And also the rhetoric that's coming from the MPs in Jordanian parliament, it's getting worse. Now, we talked about two of them, but there's a lot more. There is a lot of hate for Israel there. So I'd like to see a more active approach there to, you know, to change that. It doesn't look good. I only see things getting worse on Israel's borders, either Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, and now with a peace partner like Jordan. It's not a good sign. So those are changes I'd like to see. Hopefully it will happen. I don't know.
And me with the final word as your moderator, I would like to see Tamimi extradited to the United States. And I'm sorry, but if you are on the FBI's most wanted terrorist list with a bounty on your head from the State Department's Rewards for Justice program, sitting and vacationing and having fun in Jordan as a celebrity, there is something very, very wrong in the bilateral relationship of the United States and Jordan. And that, above all, would need to be fixed for me to have confidence in the relationship for the decade to come. Thank you so much for joining us, John Schanzer, Joe Truesman. Been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Foreign Policy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us, preferably with 5 stars. Ratings and reviews help give us visibility and the opportunity to reach more people who seek to understand the most critical national security and foreign policy issues. Also, make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow FDD on social media and visit our website at fdd.org. There you can find research by FDD experts, you can subscribe to all FDD's products, you can catch up on any past episodes you may have missed. Finally, we'd love your feedback, your ideas, your questions, your criticisms. Send us an email at foreignpodicy@fdd.org. Until next time, I'm Cliff May, and you've been listening to Foreign Podicy.